Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, September 11th, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. It's 9/11, and we'll never forget. And remember that next year, on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, the Yankees and Mets will play at Citi Field. All kinds of injury news around baseball on Thursday. The Yankees' James Paxton had a setback in his effort to come back from a flexor strain. So in all likelihood, this is going to end his season or any chance he's going to come back and help the Yankees. The Atlanta Braves' banged up starting rotation suffered another setback on Thursday when left-hander Tommy Malone was placed on the 10-day injured list with left elbow inflammation. He has a 14.90 ERA in three starts for the Braves. Dallas Keuchel, the White Sox, went on the injured list because of back spasms. There's good injury news for the Houston Astros. Justin Verlander, coming back from an elbow issue, was able to complete a bullpen of 50 or so pitches on Wednesday, and manager Dusty Baker sounded optimistic on Thursday and speaking to the reporters that Verlander could find a path back and pitch for the Astros sometime again in 2020. The San Francisco Giants on Thursday requested relief waivers on longtime infielder Pablo Sandoval. The Arizona Diamondbacks continue to overhaul their roster, and they parted ways with former All-Star infielder Jake Lamb, who just has not hit well over the last 3 years. A great night for fans of Kansas City. The Chiefs, of course, won the NFL season opener, and Royals right-hander Brady Singer carried a no-hitter into the eighth inning against the Indians.
And now Josh Naylor. And a ground ball. Dozier will take care of it.
And that's two up, two down in the eighth inning. And still Cleveland without a hit.
And now the kid is four outs away from etching his name in the Major League record books.
And now Austin Hedges. And Hedges hits a ground ball into right field. And Merrifield thought about throwing to first.
The no-hitter is broken up by Austin Hedges with two down here in the eighth. Hedges, batting 148 when the night started, gets a two-out single.
Whit Merrifield charging like an infielder and a madman was thinking, I want to get this no-hitter preserved. Maybe I can get this guy out at first.
Yeah, that's right. Whit Merrifield playing right field for the Kansas City Royals, and as he came in, he did think about throwing to first base, and Hedges, when he saw that, tried to speed up, but when Merrifield was not able to come up with the ball cleanly. Brady Singer talked about his night.
I felt really good from the start. I think it was about the probably a bad thing, but I kind of noticed there was no hits, after the third inning. So it was a stressful, however many more innings that is, stressful time. But I felt sharp from pitch one, and I was trying to stay focused the whole time, and something I really did. Obviously, I know that's what it takes, is to stay focused for 100 plus pitches or the whole game. It's not easy, but that's what it takes.
The Marlins and the Phillies, and for Philadelphia, another bullpen disaster.
Workman delivers the swing here. Base hit, center field. That will win the ball game for the Marlins. They walk it off for the first time this year. Alfaro hits one up the middle. Scoring from third base, Monte Harrison. And the Marlins have come back from a 6-3 deficit to tie and now win this ball game.
Dave Van Horn, 940 WINZ. The Phillies bullpen has now allowed 21 earned runs in 13 and two-thirds innings in their last five games, raising their season ERA to 7.14. That would be the second highest bullpen ERA since earned runs became an official statistic in 1913, and it would trail only the 1930 Phillies, who had an 8.15 ERA. The Braves and the Nationals, and the score was tied 6-6, top of the eighth inning, and this happened.
2-2 pitch. Fastball is hit in the air to center field and hit deep. Robles going back, looking up. It is out of the ballpark and gone. Dansby Swanson with his seventh home run. It's a solo shot, and the Braves lead it 7-6.
Jim Powell, 680, the fan. Dansby Swanson seems to have a knack for those big home runs when the score is close. Freddie Freeman also hit two homers, and in the month of September, Freeman batting .395 with a .500 on base percentage, five homers, and 21 RBI. Angels and Rangers, Mike Trout did Mike Trout stuff.
2-1 delivery. Trout lifts one high in the air. This ball's carrying deep out into left center field. It is Trout here. Mike Trout into the second deck at Globe Life Field. Home run number 16 of the season. Angels have had a pair of homers in this ball game against Gibson. And now the Angel lead is 4-1.
And the Angels would win 6-2. That call from Angels Radio AM 830. Oakland, the Astros, and Matt Olson came through in the bottom of the sixth.
Here's the pitch to Olson by Urquidy. Swung on a high drive. Right field. Reddick is going back. Reddick at the track. Right to the wall. He will turn and watch. And Olson has hit it out. And the A's have taken a 2-1 lead.
That from A's cast. Oakland wins 3-1. And now Oakland leads the Astros by 6.5 games in the American League West. Oakland's magic number to clinch the West is down to 11. It's been a bad year for the Boston Red Sox, but Bobby Dalbec has become a silver lining.
Here's the pitch. He had a swing and a drive down the right field line. Deep. Back it goes, and it is gone. Opposite field home run, Bobby Dalbec. He hits his sixth. He drives in his ninth run, and the Red Sox lead it 3-2. Dalbec becomes the second player in Major League history to homer in six of his first 10 games. It came on a 1-0 pitch. Oh, he crushed it to deep right field. He's homered now in five straight games. That ties a Red Sox record.
Joe Castiglione, WEI, with that call. In Los Angeles, Mookie Betts started at second base for the Dodgers. L.A. is doing this in preparation for possible postseason use for Betts in the infield. We'll be talking about that with Matt Viskersian coming up. During the course of this game, the Dodgers, who before the game placed Walker Buehler on the injured list because of a blister issue, lost another pitcher.
That ricochets off May, and Rojas will lead off the game with a hit, and Dustin in some pain.
Off the foot. And so when the foot or anything in your lower body starts to get hurt, the first thing managers and pitching coaches think about is how does that affect your body going up the chain? And then you start worrying about the arm. You start worrying about elbows and shoulders because mechanics change, the foundation changes. And all of a sudden, you can tell me your foot's okay, but if I see a limp or I see pain getting into your mechanics, it's not good for the arm.
No, that's right. And he had to come out of the game at that point. Joe Davis, Oral Hershiser, with a description of that. Arizona won that game 5-2. Now, before we get to Matt Viskersian, Chandler Rome of the Houston Chronicle to talk about the Astros, and Todd Radom with this week's quiz. Check out ESPN's newest podcast, ESPN Investigates. ESPN Investigates explores fascinating questions, revealing riveting tales, and unforgettable characters across the world of sports, all from ESPN's premier storytellers. Season 1 is titled Bloodlines and is hosted by ESPN senior writer Wright Thompson. Bloodlines examines horse racing's current existential crisis. How did horse racing go from America's most popular sport to a game driven by returns on investment? How have decades of breeding for races changed the horses themselves? And what might the dead horses at Santa Anita Racetrack in Southern California mean for the future of horse racing? Listen to ESPN Investigates wherever you get your podcasts.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Matt Viskersian is the play-by-play man on Sunday Night Baseball. Matt, how you doing this week?
Doing great, Buster. Doing great. Here we are in the home stretch of a season that just began, last week?
And meanwhile, I can hear in the background you got some homeschooling mixed in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And as soon as dad gets on the phone, it's all of a sudden that's when we need to dispense the juice and do all that stuff. So
how do your kids
ask for forgiveness?
Yeah, I was going to say, how do your kids handle that? Because my daughter, who's now in college, was so good with that. Like from the time she was 2 years old or three, I'd say, hey, dad's going to be on a call. So you got to be quiet as a mouse. And she always was. And my son, he just never cared. Like I've had so many interviews, radio interviews in particular, that have been interrupted by the sound of the big man coming through the door. How about your kids?
Yeah, it's B. It's no concern at all. You can say it. They'll say, okay. And then the next thing is the TV's stuck or I need juice or when are you done? Yeah, there's no regard at all. None.
As it should be, right? That time belongs to them.
Yeah, all the time belongs to them. Every day's kids' day, but we're fine. We're fine. It'll work out.
Exactly. All right, I wanted to get your reaction to what we got last night from the Los Angeles Dodgers announcing that they are going to be playing Mookie Betts at second base in some games during the regular season. Now, what I heard earlier in the year was that, you know, Mookie takes ground balls in the infield every day. Not a surprise because he came up as an infielder in the Red Sox organization. And when the Dodgers asked him about specific situations, you know, five-man infield, how would he feel about coming in the infield? He's like, okay, I'm ready to go. Apparently, in this case, what happened was the Dodgers, looking ahead to potential matchups in the postseason and the way their lineup is structured, you know, went to Mookie and said, hey, how would you feel about playing the infield? And his response was, well, I'd want some practice during the regular season. And that's what's going on here. And I can tell you the reaction around baseball in baseball circles was like, wait, Mookie Betts is like the best right fielder, arguably in the history of baseball. What are you doing moving him around when you got a bunch of other guys who could play second base? What was your reaction?
It was exactly the same. And I, you know, there is such a thing as being too cute. And I think this is probably the best example of that I could ever cite. I mean, if we want to go back and look at comps over the getting too cute with a star player and too many gloves in the gear bag story, Chris Bryant pops into my mind.
Yes.
You know, kind of gallivanting as an outfielder. We're not sure he's so valuable. We can use him here, there, and everywhere, to quote a Beatles song. And I don't know that any of us looked at that and said, yeah, this is great. And, you know, Chris for his part and Mookie for his part, team guys, if it's asked of them, they'll do their best to comply. And it's not a temporary thing either. I don't know that he's going to start there a lot, but the fact that they plan on putting that into the rotation, this isn't what Freddie Freeman did a couple of years ago to agree to go across the diamond and play some third base while things straightened out in Atlanta. This is, hey, we might do this moving forward and we might do this in the postseason. I'd throw another wrinkle in there too. The Dodgers, with their propensity to shift and their use of advanced defensive analytics, Mookie Betts is not going to be playing a traditional second base, for better or for worse. So whether that helps or hurts a guy that hasn't played the position since he was in the minors, I'm not sure. But remember that, you know, he is a terrific athlete, and I know the Dodgers have considered all these things. He played second base and only moved to the outfield because Dustin Pedroia had second base locked up forever in Boston. I just think it's an example of being too cute. And again, if there was no option at second base, then all right, let's roll the dice here, maybe. But they've got a glut of second basemen, including Max Muncy, who doesn't play second base much anymore. So I don't know what to make of it. Man, I wish we could just write nine names on the lineup card like we used to when we were kids and watch them play, but those days have vanished.
Yeah, you've also got Austin Barnes, who they played at second base. So there's a bunch of guys, because I've been trying to, when I heard about this, I was trying to envision the matchups that they were anticipating where they would want to do that. But in the end, not only are you taking the best right fielder out of right field, but you're also potentially, and you point out, he played second base in the minor leagues. You know, he's a terrific athlete. He probably is going to stay out of harm's way at a time when the slide rule into second base naturally takes him out of harm's way anyway, but God forbid he gets hurt. You know, something happens where he makes a move on a ball and, you know, the runner runs into him and he's in an unfamiliar place. I don't know. I agree with you. Just keep it simple and keep him in that spot. Sunday night, maybe we're going to see Mookie at second base. Who knows? We've got the Dodgers and the Astros this weekend. The first matchup since we had that situation in Houston where Joe Kelly, you know, fired the ball over Alex Bregman's head, had the back and forth with Carlos Correa, the shortstop. Do you think anything's going to happen this weekend?
I don't. I think it's happened. I don't think though there are of those rosters that don't care for one another, and it probably symbolized by Cody Bellinger on the Dodgers side and Carlos Correa on the Astros side, if only because Correa was so outspoken in defending the bad behavior of 2017 and 18. I don't know that Carlos was as guilty from an infraction standpoint as some of his teammates, but he took it upon himself to kind of become the face of defending the brand. And there are a lot of people that love that. A lot of people that feel like that was out of place. I don't think anything's going to happen, but I would say, just editorially speaking, that Joe Kelly pouty lips might be my favorite thing to have happened in 2020. And I'm talking about the calendar year, not just the baseball season. The reaction was so natural and it was so funny. And the fact that it's been lionized in artwork around Los Angeles, it's been emblazoned on T-shirts, both sanctioned and otherwise, in L.A. Dodger land. It's so great. And I can't get enough Joe Kelly pouty lips. I had it as my screensaver at one point, and I'm not a Dodger fan per se. I just thought it was such a funny reaction. It took you right back to the Sandlot. And why not, with no fans in the stands? And as we've talked about on your podcast a number of times, that kind of American Legion collegiate atmosphere in the dugout, it was taunting at its finest and at its most high level comedy. I just wish he wasn't suspended so long for it. But again, all these things work out. It was reduced and he's going to be back shortly.
And I love the genesis of it, the self-deprecating way that he told that story when he was asked on Ross Stripling's podcast about where that came from. And he said that's the look that his wife gives him when he's complaining about something, like in the morning, oh, I'm sore. And she gives him, oh, poor Joe, you know, which gave it to me anyway, more depth, like, because we've all been there, as if you've been married, like, whatever, dude, shut up.
Joe Kelly's wife sounds like she's just as funny as Joe Kelly, because I also recall the social media post over the off season of a broken window in the backyard. Yes. And it was photographed in such a way where Joe's wife said, well, Joe's working on a changeup. And then she panned left to the broken window. And that was the end of the post. It was really well done. I think those two, maybe a reality show down the road.
That would be fun. Joe Kelly's a lot of fun. All right. It looks like we're going to get on Sunday night Zach Greinke on the mound for the Astros. He's on the downslope of his career of a lot of accomplishment. 208 wins, a 3.35 ERA. And I was looking it up this morning. His adjusted ERA plus for his career is 125. It's identical to that of, among others, John Smoltz, Jim Palmer, Lefty Gomez. He's better than Juan Marichal, better than Mike Mussina, better than Bob Feller, Don Drysdale, Warren Spahn. He won a Cy Young Award in 2009. So I'm going to pose a question to you that you would normally pose to me. Do you think he's a Hall of Famer?
Oof, I had a feeling you were going there with this one. And man, is that that's a tough call. I'm a big fan of candidates who become accumulators. And I know that probably runs counter to a lot of the new baseball intelligentsia, where, you know, you have to have these microscopic analytic numbers to be considered great. If you're considered good for a long time, to me, that equals great. And for Zach Greinke, 17th season, the awards that you talk about, the win total you talk about, six-time All-Star, it puts him right in the conversation. And if we're talking about, Halliday's and Schilling's, I get it for Halliday. It's a whole different set of circumstances. For Schilling, it's the postseason body of work. I don't know who a better comp for Greinke is that's already in. I don't know, maybe Mike Mussina. That might be a little generous considering what Mussina accomplished. He's right there for me. And I don't know that I can give you an answer. I'm sorry for the terrible kind of waffling on that, but if I had to say yes or no right now, I'd probably leave it blank.
I would say yes. Like, I think eventually with these numbers, even if he didn't get voted in by the writers initially when he appeared on the ballot, he would eventually get in. You know, those are numbers that over time people would say, well, he did have a period where he was one of the elite pitchers and he would get in. I think if he gets to like 225 wins in the current context for how pitchers accumulate that number, that's going to change the view of him in a lot, eyes of a lot of writers. Even though, you know, the win totals don't matter the way they used to, I think it frames context for writers to some degree, and he would do that. And, you know, and of course, I would look forward to an induction because then we get to hear all the best Zach Greinke stories. Because, you know, there are so many regarding him. And even this year, as we're getting ready for Sunday night, I was looking online this morning at some moments this year, like that moment when he was pitching, I can't remember who he was throwing against, but he started to give this, basically yelling out to the catcher what the signs are. And then he had that 54-mile-an-hour curveball. You know, AJ Ellis, I always love the story he tells about when he walked up to Zach, who really looks at teams and team roster, team construction, and takes it very seriously, and said, hey, what would you do if you were the general manager of the Dodgers? And Zach said, you know what, I'll get back to you. And then the next day he walked up to him and said, you know what, I would replace you.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
So Zach Greinke in the way that he casts that with his blunt personality. That'll be fun on Sunday.
Filterless responses. My favorite, you know, third or fourth party Zach Greinke story, and this might be folklore, this might be complete Babylon, but I would have loved to have been on the bus when Zach Greinke is alleged to have thrown Yasiel Puig's suitcase from it. And I don't know if that really happened or not, but I guess the Puig rhetoric was dialed up so loud, everybody was discussing it, and Zach decided he would just toss his suitcase off the bus. And that was kind of a metaphor for what happened to Puig anyway.
Right, exactly. And there's no doubt, based on Zach's personality, that it's believable that he would do that. Another question I want to pose to you, during the broadcast a couple weeks ago, you posed it to Alex and to me. You didn't weigh in on that, which you tend not to do when these poll questions come up. If you had a choice for the rest of the career of Ronald Acuna Jr., Juan Soto, or Fernando Tatis Jr., who you taking?
Yeah, believe it or not, this is an easy one for me, and not because I think anything lesser of the other two, but I think that Juan Soto is about as generational a talent as there has ever been. And what he looks like as a finished product and the way he plays the game and the grown-up plate appearances that he makes at the age of 21, 22, and 20 when we first put our eyes on him. I mean, the other two guys are great and they're going to be stars and they're all three on Hall of Fame tracks. But there's just something about watching the maturity. It feels like he's the one controlling the flow of the game. And I don't know that I can say that about the other two. They still play. They still have their young man moments. I don't know that Soto does. And you know, the final piece for me on this discussion is the three home run World Series. On the biggest stage against, at the time, the greatest pitcher on the planet, yep, which is what Gerrit Cole was last fall, for him to have accomplished what he did, he's the guy for me, and it's not even something I'd think twice about.
And my favorite stat from last year was the fact that the Astros didn't allow an intentional walk the whole year, and then they faced Juan Soto.
Oh, that is a good one. Yep. He's that good. And again, I love Tatis and Acuna, but every once in a while, they expand the zone, or they'll run into an out, or something where that kind of young bull category is in there still. I don't ever see that from Soto.
Now, we're hoping that we're going to have Mookie Betts wear a microphone on Sunday. If not him, maybe it'll be Corey Seager. We'll certainly get somebody. We're also expecting to talk to Justin Turner during the course of the game. You and I had a conversation about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, about Bryce Harper and the way he helped us out on Sunday Night Baseball with the use of the microphone. We also had a great experience last weekend with Paul DeYoung of the Cardinals, who seemed to be all in on it. From your perspective as a play-by-play man, tell everybody what you think the value of all that is.
Well, I'll be real honest. I think that it needs to be refined a little bit. I love the value added component to the telecast. I love fans being able to hear what their voices sound like. I love an explanation of why a defender is standing or doing what he's doing, as Paul DeJong so generously gave us last week. The fact that Bryce kept the earpiece in through a play at the wall where it popped out, and he kept it in much longer than he was asked to, was just extraordinary, considering not only the kind of player he is, the kind of star he is, but the fact that it was a crazy game that involved a big comeback, and focus was such that he, if any point wanted to take it out, we would have said, yeah, for sure, thanks for being with us. But I think this, for me, as a play-by-play guy, I was petrified that I was going to get in Paul DeJong's way last Sunday. And I shared this with our folks at ESPN. There were two moments. There was a throw that he kind of yanked. And then there was a pickoff play at first after he singled where I thought, oh, my goodness, if this goes south, we are to blame. And that's not the case. We wouldn't have been truly to blame, but the perception would have been just that. So I think that when we mic a middle infielder live in the middle of a game, there are a lot of complexities, especially when a runner gets on base. And that's where it's up to Alex and I and you and our producers to maybe be more diplomatic about when to be in his ear when there's a runner on. In a perfect world for me, it would be an outfielder every week or a starting pitcher that's not involved in the game. I'm just petrified of the infielders being mic'd with runners on, and that again, it's up to us to dance around any trouble spots. But I'm being completely transparent with you here on the pod, in that I think it's almost perfect. It's almost there, and the cooperation that we've got has been extraordinary.
The one thing I'd say about that is, you know, I get to work with someone as talented as you, where I can hear the traffic in your ear. Like, I can hear the producers talking to you. And meanwhile, you're processing the game and you're announcing as if there are no voices in your ear. You know, I was always amazed when I would do Baseball Tonight when working with Carl Ravitch, how, you know, he'd be having highlights, you know, being teed up by the producer in his ear constantly. I didn't know how he was able to do that. I kind of wonder if just because baseball typically, you know, there's so much time between pitches, if that it's easy for someone like Paul DeJong. He's processing so much anyway that just talking about it out loud maybe isn't as difficult. Same thing with Bryce.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right about that. I'm probably exercising a little overabundance of caution in that regard. And the comp, I appreciate the comp. But I mean, for somebody like myself who's been speaking to imaginary friends in his head ever since he was a young lad, really not a problem. I've been having a friendship with Keith Moon ever since he passed away in 1978. I mean, I just talked to him over breakfast. So it's balancing the voices is okay.
All right. I know this is an anniversary for you on a pretty cool item.
Yeah. I'm a collectibles fan. I'm not a collectibles collector because I made the decision, as you may have, a long time ago. I was still working in the minors when I decided, If I continue on this collectibles track, I'm going to have one of those huge storage bin containers full of stuff that I'm never going to be able to use, display, and it's going to become a burden. So I made the decision to stop collecting, but I follow it as a fan. I'm a fan of the industry. And this weekend is the anniversary of the court decision over who got Barry Bonds' 73rd home run ball in 2002. And I know you remember the story, right? Ball into the stands, scrum. The guy who caught the ball had it grabbed out of his hands. And then he filed a lawsuit claiming that it was his property and somebody stole it. And the judge in the case, in my opinion, took the easy way out and actually cut it in half. They both gave up joint property of the baseball. The same way when you break up with your girlfriend in your first years after college, after you've made the bad decision to get a dog, you get joint property of the dog. So these guys both thought they were sitting on a treasure trove of, you know, this gold mine, this Bonds home run ball. It ended up selling over the phone for $450,000. They split it. By the time they paid their lawyer fees, I think they ended up in the red on the deal. So I just thought that was an interesting story. I mean, the collectibles industry is not as lucrative as it used to be. And I can't imagine an item that we might see, like a bat or a ball or a jersey, in the next decade that's going to be worth that. I mean, everybody thought that those Bonds and Sosa home run balls were so, you know, they were going to be so valuable. And as it turns out, nothing is really that valuable unless you're going back to, you know, like Ty Cobb's shoes or something that is never going to come around again.
Yeah, the best story, maybe the worst story, heard along those lines. You remember when Derek Jeter got his hit number 3,000, right? A home run off David Price, if I remember correctly, goes into the stands, and the kid who caught it was a college kid who made it very clear right away, like, I don't want anything. I just want to meet Derek and give him the ball. And so the kid, you know, has that opportunity, gives him the ball. Derek says something like, hey, make sure the Yankees take care of you with that stuff. And then because the kid is plastered all over the back pages of the tabloids in New York, he immediately is contacted or gets word that the IRS is going to be billing him for giving away the value of the ball.
Oh, no.
And then the poor kid, and I'm sure somebody helped him take care of it, but I was like, boy, if that's not America.
Oh, boy. I mean, the Babylon around some of those items is cool. I know Ryan Klesko has a pair of Billy Martin's boots. They are alleged to be the pair of boots that he wore in the gentleman's bar in Arlington when he got his earlobe cut off in the men's room.
Right.
So the backstory behind the boots is more interesting than the boots themselves. But I don't know. The collectible stuff is fun, and I always pay attention to it.
All right, Matt. Well, good to talk with you. Good luck with homeschooling today.
All right, Buster. It's back to kindergarten online. Here we go.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, ToddRadom.com. And I'm assuming, Todd, that there is news about the paperback release of your book, Winning Ugly.
Yes, Buster. We are all communally going through difficult times, but things are made better because the paperback of Winning Ugly, my loving homage to some of the most, and I'm air quoting here, questionable uniforms in the history of Major League Baseball, is being released in paperback in a couple of weeks, available wherever books are sold.
Yeah, and that's always a fun date when you get a book release. That's for sure. So we'll be talking about that coming up as well. Today we will start with a conversation about Comerica Park in Detroit. I think I was at the first game played there. I know, you know, historically teams have liked the Yankees to be part of their openers. And so there were several times in my time covering the Yankees that they were asked to do that. But I'll never forget, Todd, going into that ballpark for the first time. And there was, you know, that was an era when there was always excitement about Camden Yards and Jacobs Field in Cleveland and, you know, the ballpark in Seattle and in San Francisco. I remember when the ballpark in Detroit opened up, like some of the Yankees were kind of looking at it and they didn't like it very much. Like their initial reaction was like, eh, it's kind of wide open. And whereas a lot of the ballparks, they felt like brought the fans on top of the field. And boy, do we really miss that in 2020. They felt like some of the players did like it was too spread out. What do you got on Comerica Park?
Well, the first thing, Buster, is I am at a loss to recall the Tigers player outfielder who described it as Comerica National Park because of the size of it.
Yeah.
but it's so interesting that you say this because I have to say, I remember my first time visiting there. So it opened in 2000. First time I went there was in 2001. And I remember being, I'll be honest, kind of underwhelmed, not very into the kitschy aspect of these giant tigers all over the exterior, rides in the outfield and this kind of thing. And I think in retrospect, it was because of the fact that it opened around the same time as these jewels that you reference, specifically AT&T Park in San Francisco and Pittsburgh PNC, which were, you know, just boom, 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 right within, you know, right in the same time frame. But I think in retrospect, Buster, I have to say that Comerica Park is underrated to me. I really do think so. And for a couple of reasons. I love the very open outfield view because it literally embraces downtown Detroit. I know we've talked about that kind of thing with respect to a couple of ballparks, but it is a very cool thing. And it gives us, we'll say it one more time, this great sense of place. I love the retired numbers and the player tributes on that very simple brick wall.
Yep.
Outfield, right? Very elegant, almost simple, nicely done. Perfect for a ball club that wears those particular uniforms. I have to say the exterior design, it fits into the neighborhood very nicely. You feel like, you know, it's been there for 100 years, even though it's only been 20. I appreciate the fact that the club's history, this illustrious history, is all over the place, including in the concourses. It's sort of like a museum in certain respects throughout the thing. It doesn't overpower it. I like the fact that there are a lot of what we call social areas. You can hang out and have a beer, not you, because you're working. and again, all of these things that I'm saying, I appreciate far more than I did the first time I went there.
I would agree with you. It's grown on me. I've covered a ton of games there because during the time that Jim Leland was the manager, they went back to the postseason over and over and over again, World Series, playoffs, you know, working on stories on Justin Verlander. And I really grew to like the place. I mean, I always look at it through the portal of how easy it is for me to do my job. It was always good in that regard, but I like standing out on the field, doing reports from the field. I agree with that. I love looking beyond right field and into the city. That was a cool place. I got to say, I don't like it as much as I liked old Tiger Stadium. Man, what a fun ballpark. That place was so unique and so cool. And it wasn't really, you know, in my current test of utility for someone working there, it wasn't really that good. I had this really old elevator that was run by this nicest woman in the world named Sarah, who'd had no access to the outside world when she was working in the elevator. So you'd get on and you'd give her the score. You'd give her an update on where they were with the game. But the cool thing about that place was the, you know, the press box where the writers were was on the roof, and it wasn't a great vantage point to watch the game, but I would sometimes go down to the broadcast booth with the radios where the, you know, the visiting radio booths were, and it felt like you were right on top of home plate. And players, as I recall, they love playing in that ballpark. And I remember one day specifically where, like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I was covering the Orioles, Arthur Rhodes, who was a pitcher on that team, Mike Messina, some other guys grab bats and they're putting balls in the upper deck at Old Tiger Stadium. I love covering games there.
Yeah, Buster, you know, you talk about the press box. I never had the opportunity to visit the press box there, but I'm picturing these photos that we've all seen of Ernie Harwell sitting up there with the, you know, this big enclosed stadium all around him. My first visit to Tiger Stadium was in 1987. It was September. The Tigers and the Blue Jays were in a great pennant race for the AL East title at that time. And I remember it distinctly. It was a, you know, a late September Michigan day. I'm sounding like Bob Seger here or something. But I would describe the Tiger Stadium experience as a primal baseball experience. Sitting out in the bleachers there, surrounded by history and just the access to the seats. I remember distinctly sneaking down to some first row seats a couple of years after that. It was a game against the Brewers. I actually have some photos, like actual photos, not on your phone. And these were the scariest seats I have ever sat in my life. You were so close to that batter. The overhang at Tiger Stadium in right field, so many memories, so much history. I'm grateful for the fact that I got there when it was still around. And lastly, I did the logo for Tiger Stadium's final season in 1999. The club wore it as a sleeve patch on their uniform. So some little piece of me is connected to that moment. It's kind of cool.
That's really awesome. Yeah, I love going into that ballpark and working there. And, you know, the teams are always Tigers uniformly always had teams that were fun to deal with. All right, let's get to this week's quiz. What do you got?
All right, guys, here we go. In 1936-40, this team renamed itself the B, then pivoted back to their previous name, which they still use today. Was it A, the Cubs? Was it the Phillies, the Dodgers, or the Braves? They call themselves Bs. 1936-40, changed their name back to the name they use today. Cubs, Phillies, Dodgers, Braves.
Taylor, what you got?
Cubs, Phillies, Dodgers, Braves. I'll go Braves. Why not? They start with a B.
Me too.
Oh, that one was too easy. You both got it right.
I was hoping Taylor would mess it up, but, you know, that's... 2020 has been a terrible year, and Taylor keeps getting answers right.
It was a good thought buster. My reading comprehension skills are subpar. So,
And we're running out of time. But yes, the Bees and Bravesfield, they temporarily renamed the Beehive. How about that?
Oh my goodness! Yeah, that sounds like something a sports writer came up with. A dope like me. All right, Todd, thanks for doing this.
All right, guys, thanks a lot.
Chandler Rome covers the Houston Astros for the Houston Chronicle. Chandler, start with this. The other day I was talking with a baseball official who said there's no question in his mind who the manager of the year is. And he said Dusty Baker, because he feels like the Astros have been under such adverse circumstances. They got off to a slow start. Everybody got hurt. And yet it looks like they're going to make the playoffs. Tell me about Dusty Baker this year.
You know, this is not the job that I think Dusty Baker was hired for. When Jim Crane was searching for a manager, he had an odd comment in February. He said that he was talking to a group of reporters and he said, you know, you could manage this team. And he looked at one of the reporters and he said, you could manage this team. This team is as easy as just writing out the lineup every day and just hoping nothing goes wrong. Well, everything has gone wrong. You mentioned all the injuries. He's managing a bullpen now that has about 8 rookies in it. A lot of inexperience, a lot of underperformance by a lot of star players, and you know, you've got to give the Astros credit and you've got to give Dusty Baker some credit. They have found a way to remain in the playoff picture. Their record is not very good right now. They're a game under 500. They're 22-23. But when you start to look at all the injuries they've had, when you start to look at how poor their bullpen has performed, and when you start to look at everything, you sort of marvel at the fact they're 22-23 and you wonder how they got to this point. And I think it's because, you know, quite frankly, they play in a bad division. They play in perhaps the worst division in baseball, and they're talented enough to where if they roll the balls out there and if they can just have half their lineup healthy, then they're better than just about anybody they put on the field. So certainly they need to get some guys healthy. They need to get the bullpen pitching better. But the fact that they are where they are right now, given everything that's happened, is sort of marvelous.
And what, I'm just curious from your perspective, sort of what's Dusty's demeanor been throughout all this, you know, strangeness this year?
You know, it's been up and down a little bit. I think he's been at a loss for words sometimes. You know, I think during this series in Oakland where they lost four or five, there was an interesting moment where during one of the games, they walked eight-hole hitter catching Sean Murphy. They walked him three times in a game. And after the game, he's talking, and just Dusty out of nowhere goes, you know, this Murphy guy, we're pitching him like he's Johnny Bench or something. And he's sitting in the eight-hole when they walked him three times. So he's been frustrated, I think, with some of the walks. He's been frustrated with kind of some of the long losing streaks they've gone on. But again, this is part of the reason Jim Crane hired him, is because he can navigate struggles. He can navigate kind of the hard times. And this team's had a lot of hard times to navigate. And you knew that they were going to have that coming into the season. If everything was normal, you know, they'd be being booed by fans, things like that. But it's been a different sort of adverse circumstance that Dusty Baker's had to navigate. And, you know, I think he's done a pretty good job.
You mentioned some of the veteran players struggling among the position players, been so much up and down. And this is after a spring training of a lot of scrutiny and speculation following the sign stealing scandal. Tell me what you've seen in guys like Carlos Correa, Jose Altuve before he got hurt, George Springer, Alex Bregman.
They're just not hitting for power. I think that's the biggest thing right now. And maybe that's a league-wide trend. You're not seeing as much power in the league, but this is a team last year that set a major league record with a .495 slugging percentage. They're slugging .418 as of Friday morning. George Springer has just a .460 slugging percentage. Carlos Correa just .413. They both have sub 800 OPSs. I think that's the one thing this lineup is missing. They're not hitting for a ton of power. They're still scoring a good bit of runs per game, but this is a lineup that's got to find its power stroke, because I think if they can find their power, then I think it'll mask a lot of their deficiencies. I don't think this bullpen is going to get better overnight. I don't think these rookies are going to magically wake up tomorrow and have 5 years of big league experience. So they kind of are what they are on the pitching staff, but this offense is underperformed, and they've got to find a way to hit for a little bit more power. Carlos Correa, I asked him the other day why he thinks this team is not hit for the power, and he actually brought up the fact that they can't watch video between at bats and in the middle of games. And, you know, you've seen other teams bring that up and then excoriate the Astros while they're bringing that up, because the Astros are sort of part of why that is. Obviously in 2020, it's a health and safety protocol. They don't want guys going in the replay room, but Carlos Correa believes it is a little bit of not being able to watch video between at bats and making game adjustments, but everybody's got to deal with that now. It's not an excuse just for the Astros. They've got to find a way to hit for more power, especially coming up here if they want to make any sort of a deep postseason run.
Justin Verlander had a bullpen session the other day. What are their real hopes for what he might contribute this year?
It's kind of unknown right now. Dusty Baker said was that he was going to throw a bullpen session. He didn't have a report as to how it went, or more importantly, how Verlander felt afterward. I think that's the biggest thing here, obviously. But if he did throw 50 or 55 pitches, as Dusty Baker said he thought he was going to throw, then that's a little bit more than maybe even I anticipated Justin Verlander would be throwing now off of a mound. So if he can get back up to 50, 55 pitches, and then if everything goes well, Dusty Baker did say hopefully he could rejoin the Astros by the end of the month. And what role, I'm not sure. Obviously, they've got Zach Greinke as the unquestioned number one on their staff. Framber Valdez, who's going to start on Saturday in Los Angeles, has been the biggest surprise of the year for them. He's a guy that throughout his career, his control had eluded him for a while. He's really harnessed it this year and pitched really well for them. So they've got their top two starters heading into the playoffs. But obviously, getting Verlander back in any capacity would be a huge shot in the arm this team needs, because there's not much depth behind Greinke and Valdez. You know, Lance McCullers Jr. is on the injured list. We've mentioned the struggles of the bullpen. They're going to need some more. They're going to need a shot in the arm in that pitching staff. And maybe Verlander's the guy to give it to him. But, again, we don't have any specifics on how he feels, how the forearm and the elbow have recovered from these first two bullpen sessions.
Last one for you. Lance McCullers Jr. recently was quoted, I'm paraphrasing here, feeling like the scrutiny of the Astros, the criticism of the Astros has been over the top. I've talked with other players with other teams who feel like that they feel that the Astros players from 2017 haven't shown as much contrition as they would like to see. Regardless of how you would fall on that question, I'm curious if you sort of get the same feeling that I do after talking with agents, staffers, that among the many Astros who can be eligible for free agency the next 2 years, that there is some Houston fatigue, for some other way, for lack of a better way to describe it, that there are guys who are like, you know, I kind of can't wait to move on to another situation. What's your sense of that?
Well, it's difficult to get a sense of it, you mentioned, because we're not in the clubhouse. We don't get to talk to some of these guys. You know, talking to agents and talking to people within the game, I don't necessarily get that vibe. You know, Yuli Gurriel is an impending free agent, and he has spoken. He wants to come back to Houston. He's made it a point on the record to say 2 or 3 times that he wants to be back and he wants to re-sign in Houston. You know, I think traveling with them has been an interesting sort of dynamic this year, seeing how they interact with some of these teams on the road. You know, obviously fraternization is forbidden under health and safety protocols, but before games, you're still seeing them, you know, talk to other teams, and they still have the outfield conversations. You're seeing people on the base path still laugh and joke with them. Carlos Correa and Mike Trout were joking the other day in Anaheim. So, I mean, maybe they're putting on a face for what's going on the field, but I guess I haven't seen as much vitriol between players just on the field as maybe I thought I would. Now, maybe when they're interviewed, maybe when they speak on the record, there are things that they just want out there. But I haven't really seen maybe as much as the interviews and some of the blast quotes would suggest as far as hatred goes. But, you know, when free agency rolls around, the Astros do have some decisions to make, with George Springer specifically, Michael Brantley, two guys that they need, that they could use in their outfield next year, an outfield that's going to be pretty depleted. Whether they want to stay here or not, I'm not sure whether it depends on the signed ceiling scandal and the fallout, but I can tell you this, that if fans are allowed back in the stands in 2021, then it's going to be a rough road for the Astros, because no few people have forgotten what happened. And a lot of fans, just judging up based off of my Twitter mentions and based off of just what I see from people, people have not forgotten. People want their chance to excoriate the Astros in person.
All right, sir. Well, good to talk with you, and thanks for helping out, especially from the West Coast early on a Friday morning.
All right. Thanks, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. First up, Danny Sudeiktik at DSuds24. Hey, Buster and Taylor. Are they still doing Manager of the Year awards? If so, would Sandy Alomar be a potential winner, considering he had to take over for Tito midseason? Has that ever happened before?
Boy, gosh, there's some example in the back of my head of somebody stepping in, but I think it was a case where, like, the manager, it was scheduled that he was going to go away, and then a guy came in and he wound up being... No, I don't think a pure interim manager situation, that doesn't strike a chord. I don't think Sandy Alomar would win. He's done a terrific job since taking over. I do think Kevin Cash, the manager of the Tampa Bay Rays, probably is the inside track at this point. Hmm.
Jim Misner is up next at Jim Misner 87. He writes in, we know that saves are a newer stat, but is notching 400 saves the imaginary line, similar to 300 wins as the line that separates the good from the all-time greats?
I don't think so. I don't think the writers have sort of hardened a particular number, because there are guys in that 400 range who haven't come close to being elected to the Hall of Fame. I think because for a lot of writers, saves is kind of a junk stat. They don't treat it with as much respect.
Got it. Last one for today. Our pal PK Steinberg writes in, Buster, now that we're approaching autumn, which is the more insidious thing you found in your yard, dandelions or crab grass or yellow nutsedge? Never heard of that one.
Moles. Moles? You know, forget all that, PK. It's the moles. I kind of feel bad because I love animals. But the moles are driving me crazy. Once they start burrowing around and you see the damage they do, I've got a neighbor who's got a mole trap, and, you know, it doesn't end well for the moles. That one kind of drives me crazy.
Mm, interesting. War on moles here in the off season. It was,
yes,
dandelions back in the spring and the summer. So we've shifted.
But this one
campaigns
might happen under the radar. Like, I don't think I'll be telling everybody about my war on the moles, if in fact that's what happens. It'll be like guerrilla tactics.
It's going to get bloody out there. All right, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Buster, what do you got going on this weekend?
You know, we got the Dodgers and the Astros and Sunday Night Baseball working on this weekend on SportsCenter. We got a great feature on AJ and Kate Pollock, and the birth of their daughter, Maddie Mae, who was premature and was born in 1 pound and 6 ounces. That's something to look forward to. I know you today, I'm assuming you're all fired up about this Orioles-Yankees doubleheader.
I'm not super fired up. I'm going to watch both, but I don't really like doubleheaders, man. I feel like they always just kind of pan out. Teams always split them. I feel like doubleheader sweeps are a little bit more rare, so I'm a little bit down on today. I'll be watching all weekend, but the wind is out of my sails, at least for this afternoon and this evening.
I got to say that, you know, that sort of defines you as a glass half empty type personality, right? That you look at the doubleheader as being like not really an opportunity that it is. And after you mentioned this to me, that you are a doubleheader fatalist, I reached out to Hembo and asked him, okay, we have to tell Taylor exactly what the percentages are of sweeps versus splits. He got this number from Elias this morning. 53% of doubleheaders result in sweeps. 47% result in splits.
Okay. I guess there's some slight hope. I don't know. I feel like that says like kind of the same thing.
Listen to you. You're not buying it at all.
No, I feel like it kind of proves my point. Like half the time they split, half the time they sweep.
No. You said always they split. And most of the time they sweep. So come on. As an Orioles fan, get fired up for your team today. They might walk, you know, pick up a couple games on the Yankees.
I'm fired up for sure. I mean, yeah, if they can at least split the series, I'll be very happy.
Well, very nice. That's it for today. That's it for this week. My thanks today to Matt, to Chandler, to Todd, to Taylor. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we have to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.